You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello, my name is Sean Cleland. I'm a collaboratively trained attorney and a mediator. I founded Cleland Collaborative Solutions with the goal of helping people to improve how people in our community think about and approach divorce. For those who have experienced divorce as I have, you know that divorce is much more than a legal problem involving rights. Divorce can have a profound negative effect on our health and finances. It can have a devastating effect on our children. My podcasts will provide you with the perspective and information needed to achieve a healthier divorce and a better post-divorce life. Today we have Emily Elber as a guest. Thanks for coming, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Emily is the person who helps me with my marketing for Cleland Collaborative Solutions. You can imagine in these conversations we have that divorce comes up occasionally. So, and Emily have the background of having gone through divorce from our parents. So we have a lot in common in that way. And I think that helps us actually, you know, to market the business well.
And you're my mom's boss.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, so we thought, hey, let's have a show together. Let's talk about divorce. We seem to know something about it. And you know, so really today we're going to talk about generally divorce, what it is, and how to wake people up to you know, what divorce can do to people and some of the experiences that people have from
and
divorce.
Some of the kind of moving forward from the classic topics of divorce. I know when we talk a lot in our marketing meetings or just, you know, before podcasting, a lot seems to come up about hot topic issues that go beyond, you know, filing documents and choosing lawyers and child, like, custody. So there's a lot of other hot topic issues that I think are, and I'm learning from you as well, how they're connected with what's going on today in terms of overall well-being and general health. And I always like to hear what you have to say about what you think people need to be paying attention to and who else they need to be paying attention to.
Right. Now, let's get at it. A lot of the times when you read about divorce, you are going to read about some little portion about it, you know, the court system. You're going to read about co-parenting. But there aren't a lot of people that write about the actual, you know, the harm it might cause to children, for example. What kind of harm are we talking about?
I see a lot of blogs on co-parenting, but not on a lot of what's going on with the children or what was going on during their divorce process.
Well, if someone can tell you that a kid is going to be more likely to be a drug addict or more likely to have relationship issues when they get older, but there isn't a lot of discussion for why that is. So that's kind of some of the insight you have if you've experienced divorce, to kind of, oh yeah, I can see why this could happen. I can see the kind of psychic injury somebody might suffer from a divorce. So I think the experience gives you that kind of knowledge.
Yeah, it's nice to and refreshing to see to work with you and to just being somebody who went through divorce when I was, I think that the process probably started, obviously, before I was even aware, at about 5 or 6 years old. And I know you and I connect over kind of the shared experience of divorce, but that the outcomes were a little bit different and, you know, things were different variables. It's been really refreshing to talk to you. And the one thing that we obviously had in common, aside from you knowing my mom forever, was that we both are children of divorce. And I always like to hear your experience since we sort of went through similar but very different situations.
Right. Yeah, you know, when I think about divorce from my parents, I mean, the first thing that kind of comes to my mind is that it's a – the feeling that I am left with thinking about, because my parents' divorce was a high conflict divorce, as I think your parents was, and that when you have a high conflict divorce, what happens is that a child tends to think, depending on the age too, but I think I was about 12 years old, and you have one parent who is, you know, you know certain traits about your mother, for example, and you know certain traits about your dad, and you kind of idolize certain things about your parents that you like, And the great thing about being a kid is like, oh, I'm like this great project. I'm this wonderful part of my mom. I'm a wonderful part of my dad. And I'm just going to go out there and kick some butt in the world. And you're really, you know, that's really gives you your identity. But when a divorce occurs and it's a high conflict divorce, children tend to think differently of their parents. I'm made up mm-hmm. of two people who can't get along. Therefore, in my own mind, my who I am is a sum of conflicting parts. So there must be something kind of that doesn't work for me either, because what I idolize about my dad and idolize about my mom are going to cause conflict. So that's the impression that I recall having. You know, who knows when I thought of this stuff? It surely wasn't when I was 11.
Right.
But that's – I think when I try and impress upon clients, like, you know, when they're struggling with divorce and I'm trying to keep their focus on the kids, that's one of the things I always raise with them, is that, you know, you reason you want to stay on the same page and keep the conflict down and work on that is because that's what you're going to teach your kids, and that's right. going to cause all those other issues you read about, you know, statistics of drug abuse and all these other things. You need to know the reason for that in order to address the behavior.
Yeah, when I sent you that screenshot the other day over text, that was kind of covering how many children feel like they're responsible for bringing their parents back together, or that they were at fault for a divorce. What's interesting in this conversation is that you just explained your identity as being a sum of two people, and I'm adopted. So I didn't have that at all. So my reaction was just to split and teach myself. And there was really, I didn't have that sort of
right.
Your mindset.
I can't imagine. I mean, just from what I understand, I mean, you found out that your parents are getting divorced almost about the same time you found out you were adopted.
And yeah.
So where do you base your life from? Who are you is mm-hmm. an immediate question that must pop in your mind, because we are, you know, everybody knows innately, even children know that they are what their parents made them, and they're always learning about themselves by watching their parents.
And with the actions speak louder than words with your parents.
Correct.
I don't remember my parents telling me that my father was moving out and that it was divorce time. I barely remember them telling me that I was adopted, but I knew what was happening and I could see what was happening around me. And it was just a massive amount of I was feeling abandoned.
Right. Yeah.
And that I couldn't even understand, comprehend, or process that emotion at that age.
Well, that's a big issue too. I mean, divorce, and a 6-year-old is going to react differently, obviously, than someone who's 11.
Right.
But it immediately causes – I mean, in my experience, I was immediately like – this became a massive focus of my thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, it totally conquered and was stronger than anything else going on. And so thinking about it, why is this going on? Who's right and who's wrong, the situation you're in. I mean, my parents were in the same house for a long period of time after they decided to get divorced, even though it was high conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like just
bad energy.
Really bad energy for a long
yeah.
time. And in that, you cannot think rationally in a school when
no.
you're in a high conflict situation.
You're not comfortable in your own home.
No, right. So, like, you know, sit down and try and do some math when, you know, there's screaming and yelling at home. It's not going to work out.
Even ignoring.
Right.
That tension can be just as nasty.
You can't ignore it
mm-hmm.
Because you care about your parents, and so you're worried what's going on with them. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're really concerned about them. And so really what ends up happening is that you just cannot keep up with school in these instances. I could not. I didn't care any longer. I wanted to know the depth of what's going on. Why is this happening? I really want to understand the root problem, understand it, maybe to solve it. But whatever
yes.
it was, I wanted to know what it was. And that kind of led me
mm-hmm.
I couldn't care less about math and all these other
yeah.
subjects. I mean, reading Raisin in the Sun was like, okay, I've got bigger problems,
right.
bigger fish to fry than this one. So I just kind of let school go for a long period of time at a young age. And that that's something that, you know, parents have to keep in mind too. I was in school in the early 80s when this was going on. World's a little different now. I mean, it's so competitive.
Mm-hmm.
I know that from my own kids. You put a kid behind for just a year nowadays, And good luck catching up,
right?
And getting into that school that you want them to get into. So, you know, giving them a real firm foundation from which they're not going to be scared. You know, they're not going to be distracted from.
Distracted.
Is important.
Well, yeah, and to kind of go back to the question being, you know, you're saying that you sort of tried to turn into a problem solver
right.
in the situation, and did you feel responsible, or did you feel like you were capable of fixing it?
You know, that's a funny thing. I have always heard that, and I'm not negating it, because, you know, these experts out there know what they're talking about mm-hmm. when they – because they interview kids, they talk to kids, and many kids have expressed that I thought I was the problem. And I suspect that might be the case in many divorces, just on the factual situation involved. In my own personal – I never felt that way, that I can at least think of that I was the blame for – I mean, what became the problem, and really was that – and this might have resulted in my lifelong kind of disdain for court-based divorce and how it's not effective. But back then, the court was obsessed with knowing what me and my brother wanted to do. It was our decision who we lived with.
That's wild.
And I can tell you now that if you want to have pressure on a kid who's 12 to say, you decide which parent you want to live with, and your parents are always asking you when you're going to make up your mind – you know, and you know that this conflict can end at any moment when you just decide, but you can't make that decision because it's like telling a parent you don't want to live with them. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, that's
insane. So that was pressure that I will never feel again. That was insane pressure, like just excruciating.
That's like a dramatic scene in a film. Like I can't even. We didn't have that option. Maybe because my parents were in the legal field and my dad's an attorney, and they
right.
I don't know how they went through that. I know that they were in court situation, but
well, they sent a it was a court ordered psychiatrist or psychologist. I'm mm-hmm. not sure. And I remember looking at pictures of ink blots and stuff like
ugh.
That. But like, you know what's going on. You're like, if I say this, it looks like a turnip. Does that mean I want to live with my mom? You're like, you're petrified
yeah.
of what's going on. So it was real intense. And I remember to this day, I remember the release of tension when I made it known that I wanted to live with both of them, like, you know, joint custody or I'm sorry, I guess shared parenting time was something that like no one had thought of. It was like that just wasn't something that was on the table. I'm like, I want to do 50-50. It was like, okay, we'll do that. And I was like, oh, my God, that's the greatest thing ever. And it seems like why the hell didn't someone suggest this to anyone else? I mean, I'm
yeah.
so, you know, putting that kind of the conflict's there, and then putting the responsibility on the child to resolve the conflict tells you just how backwards courts were back in the early 80s time frame, and how you know, things have gotten better, but still you know, just how bad it was.
So in the dynamic that you had with your siblings, were they on the same page?
Yes.
Did you guys talk about it?
No.
Just reacted individually, and it was
pretty
awkward
much.
For everyone?
Yeah. So I was, you know, in that seventh grade kind of frame of mind.
That's scary.
And my brother was I was actually sixth into seventh until the end of like seventh, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was he was already in high school when I was in seventh grade. So, you know, he had his own buddies. He could go off, and he had real close friends, you know,
yeah.
God bless them, that he could just kind of stay out of the picture for the
right.
most part. So he did not get involved. I was always the one that was trying to, like, you know, let's fix, you
There's
know.
There's always that one.
If someone looks like they really need a hug,
yeah.
I'm there. You know, it's like – so it was like playing lifeguard for a while.
Yeah.
So it really set me up well for my role as a mediator
right.
later in life.
Makes
so,
sense.
Right, it does.
Yeah, my brother – we'd say 6'7" and Philip was 5'6". And our two separate reactions were, I mean, they couldn't have been any different. And I was kind of, you know, went into my own zone, and he started lashing out, but he was lashing out at me
mm-hmm.
because he couldn't lash out at my parents. He was my mother's like son and like prized possession, and he's so protective of her. And my dad just sort of, I mean, they told us that they were getting a divorce, but I don't remember that. And I don't, I didn't see that in action until my father moved out of the house. And then I was confused why he was coming home wearing a suit shirt and playing with me for a limited amount of time and leaving. And that upset my brother really badly. And, he wound up taking it out on me, and that turned into just, you know, the spiral. I mean, just out of control. So every emotional health issue, you know, alcoholism, things that develop when people start having self-esteem problems. I mean, that was the direction that I went into, and my siblings handled it very differently. And, you know, one went dark, and then two of them went dark, two or three. Right. I mean, we all did, but it was right. Just it was in a different way, and it was a wild division. And I was looking at family photos the other day, and it didn't occur to me until we started working together and we've been having these conversations that are really cathartic, that I've always wondered when the hand holding in photos between me and my brother stopped, and right. When we stopped being best friends and taking pictures, you know, riding the clothes basket down the stairs. And it was at the time that my parents got a divorce.
Right.
And the reactions were, it just was wild. And it takes a long time, I think, for children when they evolve through all of that to come back. I'm 34 years old, and I'm now just making the connections, because my parents didn't talk about it. There was a high conflict divorce, but they were quiet.
Right.
We didn't hear anything. We didn't know anything. We were just told stuff. And then we saw the interactions and the behaviors. I had no idea that my parents would prefer to not even look at each other in public. Right. I had no clue.
Right.
And it was so easy to slip through the cracks. Got me in some trouble in high school playing the, I'm going to papa's, like going to mom's, because they didn't check, you know, they didn't do the due diligence.
No
communication.
Right. Of course. So, the kids, depending on the age of the children are going through divorce, they're just not able to process what's going on. Like you talked about how your father would come home and we're all dressed up, and then he'd leave and you'd be like, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Kids don't know what that means. They know something's not right, but they don't know. There's no way to make it right for them immediately. You can explain to them, you know, calmly what's going on, and if the parents are getting along, it's quite helpful, because it looks to them like everything's okay, even though things have changed. As long as the parents look like this is okay, this is fine, you're going to be fine, and we're all going to be okay with this, then the children might breathe a little bit and just kind of wait and see. I mean, but eventually kids are going to need to know once they're able to think better and understand things better. And so you don't want to, you know, rely on just yourself. And
oh, yeah.
If you want to get experts. Now, like the stories that we share is that our parents basically just let us go. Like there was no understanding that what had just gone on was really bad for us.
Yeah.
That we suffered an injury, that we were put in a position that would really cause us some trouble. And so had they had done that and said, you need to go, we need to get you to this psychologist and help you think through these issues, especially as you got older, and so you could work through them knowing that you had suffered this injury. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
But even psychologists back in the day, I was a little too smart, and I knew that my parents were paying them, so I was not talking to you, because I knew exactly where that information was going.
Right. Well, and like I said, like there's a time and a place for it, but there's got to be
– oh, yeah.
You know, there has to be some ways of the children – if the parents recognize the kids are going through something like this, they've got to get them some help.
And I'm saying more now, especially with the type of practice you have. Had I gone through divorce – where it was more collaborative, mindful, you know, and, you know, a big group effort. Like, I think had I then been introduced to therapy, I wouldn't have been so closed off, because I had that vibe that it was like something's not right, and like I'm scared to say things about mom or about my dad because I don't know who's going to hear what, and if I tell, you know, and I did, I started lying a lot. I would say things about my dad if my mom was picking me up, because they would have like a half hour. It was one of those, they'd pick me up from therapy, and then I remember it would be, you wait in the hallway while we speak to your mom. And I'm like, this is insane.
Yeah, the first thing that kids are going to pick up on, at least this is what I think I picked up on, is that they're not talking to one another again.
Right.
And when they do talk, it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens, that's the first thing that you're going to notice. And so when the communication breaks down, there's no more talking to your parents. There's talking to one side or the other. And that's the end of all communication. I mean, what I love about mediation and collaborative practice, when you talk about high conflict divorces, is let me back up. When you're doing divorce court, and like our parents were, you're told not to talk to the other side. So it kind of reinforces. You're already angry.
Yeah.
You're already being, upset, and your life's turned upside down, and there's some you know, real heartfelt injury in divorce. So it's understandable that people would have trouble communicating. But when they don't communicate, kids pick up on that. And that's what causes increased conflict. That's what causes kids to see that, you know, wow, I don't have parents to talk to anymore. Because they can't talk with one another any longer.
I developed generalized anxiety disorder at around 11 years old.
Well, because, right. But you remember, as I do probably, that if you ever were in an event where both your parents would show up at the same time, it was awful. I remember like Little League baseball games.
Yeah.
I'd be like in these like all-star games, and I would be like sulking in the dugout. And it wasn't that they were doing anything wrong. It was just that presence of both of them in the same place. I could not concentrate on the game.
Yeah.
I lost interest in it. And so that's what you need to be focused on. And so the whole point here is that in mediation and collaborative practice, you're encouraged to communicate. You're told you have to communicate. This is the only way to resolve this in a healthy way for you and your kids. Even if you don't have kids, you need to be communicating to get this done appropriately. But by doing so, you'll be able to model that with your kids during the divorce and after, and that's what dissolves the conflict. Even if you can't agree, you can talk, and being able to show your kids that you can talk in front of them, they're not going to be scared half to death when you both show up to a school concert. And even though you're not even sitting together, your presence in the same room will be a sign of conflict in their world. Unless you two can at least sit down together and model that you can be talked to together.
Well, and then it can make people like you feel like you're part of the problem solving.
Right.
And then you don't need to become so devastated on your own in your bedroom by yourself.
Right, exactly.
You know, thinking it through.
Right. You know, so a huge part of this, and it's not that divorce is always going to cause trouble. It's the conflict, really, when you get down to it. It's the lack of communication and the lack of understanding of, you know, what divorce does to kids that really causes a lot of the trouble. And, you know, co-parenting certainly in the – at least you were probably, what, in the 90s when this is going on. I'm in the 80s, so
– I was late 80s.
Yeah, late 80s. Okay, yeah. So it's – that's right, because you were six.
Yeah.
So that's – you know, co-parenting wasn't a big deal back then. That wasn't something that really had been – taken up as
no,
a cause.
It was actually okay. So more than one.
I'm the Kramer versus Kramer generation. You're the War of the Roses generation. Okay, so
more. I had more than one set of parents, like of my friends. I remember hearing your parents had the ideal divorce.
Yeah. What does that mean?
And I was like, hi, I'm like getting high and drinking all the time. Yeah. Like, what? What? In high school, they were like, this is perfect and ideal. And I'm like, why? Because we've nailed down that we live four blocks away from each other and that every other Wednesday we go to Phil's house. And then, you know, every other weekend, like we're back. And we're all close to school. And then, you know, our parents like orchestrate this like these drop off schedules when we had the blue bag, which was like if it didn't go in the blue bag, it wasn't going to the other person's house.
Yeah.
And it was a disaster if something was missing from the blue bag. Well, at that time period, people thought No one talked about it. People didn't know our personal business. Everyone was coping personally, privately, destructively.
Right.
And so it was being reinforced to me that my parents had some perfect divorce. And as you know, as we've both gone through adventures of podcasting and starting, you know, different efforts, I'm not even realizing the full extent of the trauma until I went into recovery 3 months ago, got my head screwed back on straight, and really started doing work on myself that this has been impacting me for a long time.
Right.
And it wasn't seen. Divorce wasn't ever seen. When I would even say to a therapist at some point, not to my current therapist, she is amazing, but in the past with other therapists, divorce was like, oh, no big deal. I mean, that was not really even considered that much of a, like, that big of a trauma. It was like, okay, let's talk about the childhood abuse. Okay, let's talk about alcoholism. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. But divorce is, like, so common that people aren't identifying this as being just disastrous.
Right. And again, it's the conflict in them. It's, and so it's, there can be divorces with kids that aren't going to cause a lot of trauma. I mean, if someone decides to get a divorce, I'd hate for them to think that that automatically means anything. But to the extent that you don't, you cannot cooperate with the other side, there's high conflict during it, and there continues to be conflict after the divorce, you are setting up your children for lots of trouble. And so, yes, that's. Why is that? Why is it hidden? You know, there's an article I read a while ago, and it had a great title that says, you know, divorce is the hidden injury.
Yeah.
And when we know that high conflict divorces are about as bad for children as really bad poverty.
Yeah.
You know, how much worse can it get? So it's not that science hasn't caught up to the fact that divorce is for kids. They have. But we haven't as a society really decided to address it that way. And that's the whole point here, is that we need people to recognize that the way things have been done is not solving the problem. And it's – you know, if we really want to help kids, if we really want to help communities – we have to wake people up and say, this is a big problem. And so we need to think about how we're going to go through divorce. Think about, if you have a family member who is going through a high conflict divorce, are you talking to them about how they're handling the conflict with the kids? Because if you're not, you're letting that kid suffer, and that's going to be possibly a lifelong problem for that kid. So it's really important not to hide this. And, you know, just talking about divorce is usually something people are like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather take a nap or maybe punch myself in the face and talk about this.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get people to wake up to it because it is kind of painful. And frankly, a lot of people think it's a private family matter.
Well, and this is where this becomes – I mean, this is now a common thing that you and I talk about, is it's important to hear people like you and I talk about the long-term effects of divorce. We have to be those voices because this is, you know – not something people want to talk about. We're still talk about adding in with children the fact that we have social media, and so there's a whole other projection problem of, you know, everyone living their best life online. So I'm sure that the traumatic situations that kids face with divorce are twice as harsh. They're harsh in a different way, but, you know, there's that whole that part that's going on, but that I was never exposed to. But that I can see being a huge problem, and must be. But I know I can only speak for myself. After going through discussing an adoption, abuse, and divorce, and this is, my mother is 100% comfortable with me speaking about this because it is the truth.
Right.
When she heard my podcast recently where I was discussing these things as it pertains to addiction, she cried. She wishes that there were an opportunity for her to handle the divorce back in the 80s in this type of way, so I wouldn't be suffering in such dark, terrible pain in my 30s.
Right.
And I mean, what it really came down to was the adoption wasn't as traumatic as the divorce. I was maybe probably set up to feel a little bit abandoned, but I also got adopted by some pretty solid people. So that could have been, you know, a sweet recovery. But then it was like, yo, you're adopted. Now we're splitting up and not explaining this to you. Right. I'm like, I'm by myself and no one cares.
Right.
And that is, I mean, that's not the way you want to set up a child's self-esteem, to set their self-esteem up and to set their perspective of relationships.
Right. Now, then that's what that's what really needs to happen, mm-hmm. is that, you know, brave people like you, Emily, need to come out and talk Thanks. About what they go through. And so, because they want to help other people. And it is hard because, you know, we're talking about things that aren't just involving us. We're talking about our parents who, yeah. you know, you love your parents like I love my parents.
They were doing the best they could.
They could. And it's really what they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it? I mean, it's really that they didn't know that
our parents are definitely. I don't know. I mean, I don't know your family personally, but I know that had our parents had this type of option, it would have been a completely different story. Right. No one was unloving. No. We all, in their minds, we were coming first. They right. thought they were doing the best that they could for us, and they thought, I think, kind of hiding things and making it the hidden injury because that was the way to live. I mean, people are the product of like the 50s. I mean, my grandparents. World War II. I mean, we're talking like, you know, that was the way that people handled problems. And that was kind of a method of protection from their perspective.
Right. So and I acknowledge that. And mm-hmm. so this isn't about blame whatsoever.
No.
This really isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is about how, you know, not knowing and really now that we know. I mean, I had last week Sonia Thompson on from Kara, Southeastern Michigan, who puts on classes about co-parenting. And we talked a lot about, you know, why co-parenting has become more of a, you know, it's a hashtag. It's talked a lot about. It's very popular as a subject matter. And she said it pretty eloquently, I thought. She said, we know more.
Yeah.
You know, we now know what we didn't know not too long ago. And it's well publicized. It's not just some one author with a theory. This is documented stuff. We do know that these problems are the result of high conflict divorces. Mm-hmm. So, and we know what we can do now to prevent that. And what you need to do if you're a parent and you have kids and they're going to go through a divorce, there's no the excuses that we might give our parents, which are earned excuses, just not knowing. I mean, it's not their fault. I don't know that you can give the same free passes today that we could give to our parents.
We now live in a time where people are having conversations.
Right.
And people are accepting of that.
Right.
And everybody feels like there is a platform to be heard that they can, like what we're doing right now.
Right.
And so there are no excuses.
No.
There aren't.
Once you know, I mean, these are handling a divorce in a way that allows you to co-parent, allows you to reduce the conflict down to a mm-hmm. manageable amount so that you can be good parents. Being a good parent in co-parenting isn't a good parent, good dad and good mom working in isolation in different universes. It's parenting is a partnership even if you're not married.
Yes.
So it's working together. It's communicating. That's what you need to have. That's what you need to work towards. And now we have skills. There's classes. There's ways of getting divorced. Again, I'm big on the fact that the process that you use to get divorced mm-hmm. will affect all of these things.
Yeah.
That's where we need to focus. And the sad thing is that courts today, I think, recognize these things. They will make you take classes to teach you some of these things. But
that's stale.
Well, the problem is that they're not equipped to do it well. They might send you to a class where you learn about it in a videotape, but they're not really – it's not part of the process.
No, it's not interactive.
Again, the rules are set in such a way – it's an institution that's been around for ages. And frankly, when you resolve divorces the same way you resolve criminal proceedings or anything else, it's a trial. It's a contest. Mm-hmm. Attorneys are combative. They're adversarial, fighting only for their own clients, talking about rights.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a structure in which you can create a good co-parenting foundation for children. It just isn't. It's not the judge's fault. There are really, really intelligent, caring, wonderful people in the court system. They're just, in my opinion, in a system that's not allowing them to give the results they'd like to give.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. Right now in our state legislature, there is a proposal. And that proposal would, in effect, make it so that parenting time will always be shared equally between a mother and father. Mm-hmm. There are some exceptions to the rule, but that will be the general rule, all right? The way it is before this bill was introduced, the way it is currently, is that the court's going to look at what's in the best interest of the child. They're going to run through a bunch of factors, and they're going to decide on a case-by-case basis. People that want this bill to pass say, look, giving the judges the discretion to decide on a case-by-case basis results in skewed rulings, mm-hmm. that one parent gets the child. Shared parenting is not granted very often, and there's some discrimination against fathers that complain about. On the other side, the people who are against this bill say we should be giving them all the attention in the world, these individual families. That we should do it on a case-by-case basis. So the problem really is in total what no one's talking about is that the courts aren't equipped. Of course we should be giving families individual attention, but they're not equipped to do it. They can't possibly have it. They don't have enough resources, enough people, enough time, mm-hmm. not even close to deal with what we now understand today in our modern world is divorce and its problems. It's not just property and it's not just who gets parenting time. There's more to it than that to solve the crux of the problem. So courts can't do it. And the resolution or the proposal to fix that problem by this bill is to take away mm-hmm. the judge's discretion, and you get every time you get divorced, this will basically be what you end up with.
Yeah.
And so it's a cookie cutter approach. So that's not what we need either.
No,
the option is to get out of the courts to resolve your divorce.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, both of my parents are sound. So that was, I mean, I'm grateful. Got to give it to my parents that, you know, either way, no matter what would have happened, you know, we were safe in either situation. My best friend, one of my best friends, in court divorce, she wound up with her mother, who was a bipolar alcoholic who abused the hell out of her emotionally.
Right.
And her father didn't get to have time, and he took off and started a new life in Florida.
Right.
And it was like, really, was that in her best interest?
Right.
Like, come on. And how can no one's going to come forward and say, I'm an alcoholic and I have bipolar disorder. And you know what I'm saying? Like, and especially if the father had issues of his own, he's not going to bring those things up.
Right.
So how could a judge make a fair ruling for what's best for an individual family with individual sets of circumstances?
They don't have time to do that. They don't have the time. It's not
their
fault.
Impossible.
It's impossible.
Correct.
To get to know. Mm-hmm. You really need to get to know people to help them. You need to really spend time listening, talking. You know, and that's just something that courts, they're not able to do very well. They've got a lot of people running through. These people are swamped a lot.
They stay detached. I mean, I can't imagine if everyone got so emotionally invested into their work that it would even be possible to do.
Yeah. And it's not that, you know, when I hear my clients' problems, I mean, you do have to.
I mean, judges.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's in the position of dealing with family strife and problems, I mean, these are people who are suffering.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to understand why it is they're suffering mm-hmm. Without, you know, feeling it the same way. I guess because I went through it, I feel like that's one thing I've been able to do to pull out of my background, and that mm-hmm. is I can totally get how people are feeling in just about every position in divorce, because as a kid, I thought about every position. My mom was in, my dad was in, I was in, my brother was in.
Sure.
You don't stop thinking about it. So I get that. So I can really help people think through these things, how their kids are feeling. That's what I like to do, because I can give that kind of perspective. But I don't ever feel that I get so – I mean, I'm rooting for my clients. I'm mm-hmm. hoping for them. But I don't feel like I'm just getting burnt out hearing their stories, because I've lived that story my whole life.
It's inspiring
I'm used to
you to do your work.
Right. Right. It does.
Yeah.
You know, if you went through something as a kid that was kind of traumatic, it's people want to turn that into something good mm-hmm. when they get older. They want to share, like you're doing today. You're sharing your experiences to help other people, because you know that you went through this for a reason. And maybe this is a reason that you can help people to do better down the road. And that's the exact reason why I started Cleveland Collaborative Solutions, honestly.
And even having the opportunity to work with you has already been absolutely cathartic for me and my family. We've now been able to open up the discussion, and the conversations I've had with my mother and the things that I've been able to share with my father would not have been heard had I not had... I kind of sort of can say, I'm working for Sean Cleland now, so this is like, you know, an expert opinion. Right. And, you know, they're more willing to listen to that, as anyone would when, you know, you have a little bit of professional, right, you know, backup. But even working with you, doing your marketing has, you know, had a tremendous impact on my family. And
the power of communication. That's all it is.
It's
that... You know it's not easy. You know it's hard. You know it's extremely hard to do. And sometimes you can't do it on your own. But that is the solution. It is the solution to talk, to not hire someone who's going to tell you not to talk.
Right.
To not let someone else do the talking for you. To not bury yourself. Close right. your eyes to the problem. You face it head on. Mm-hmm. It is extremely hard, but there are – lots of people out there in this world who are experts to help you through that process. And
right.
if you believe, as I'm telling you to believe, that that's how you will resolve the problems you have, and you know, you'll be better off for it. That's the whole point of this.
Totally. And working, as I posted on Facebook on my personal page that I included you in, was that even working with you, now that you've helped me identify through your work where things went wrong for me as a child and how big of a deal that was, which is supported by my parents and by my therapist, and, you know, is the truth. Right. That's been instrumental in my recovery from addiction.
Well, you know, what helps, I think, when you do communicate with someone mm-hmm. else and when we get to share stories, is that you get to see your own life from a different perspective. You get to right. understand, like, if I can share with you how it affected my, like, self-esteem when, like, I was in middle school and all of a sudden math, like, just left my consciousness. I could not possibly do math in seventh grade.
Yeah.
I lost it. And just because of what was going on in my mind, I was so frazzled. And that lasted for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And how that affected me. Hearing those stories, you're like, oh, I can – yeah, that's how I felt about something else, that
yeah.
same kind of inability to kind of think through things or to be on the same level as other people in school or something.
Well, you're also giving validation
right.
to these feelings.
Right. And at a certain point, the strength is if you've gone through it, you simply understand other people that are going through it too.
Mm-hmm.
That is a – education you don't get from law school
right.
or mediation training or anything else. It's just the experience counts for a significant amount of why I like to help people, because
well,
I
you're very through. You're very intuitive, and so I think that is what makes you so good at what you do, is that you're very perceptive and you're very sensitive to, like, the greater good.
I'm handling Emily at 20 right now.
I mean, I see what you post on the Wendelberry forums. I know that, you yeah. know, you're very philosophical and deep thinking, which I trust, and I think it's wonderful. And, you know, it's such a pleasure to work for you.
I appreciate that.
I've learned a lot.
Well, on the flip side, you know, that's the reason why we work well together, because mm-hmm. you understand what I'm trying to do and why I'm doing it, so you can help me with the message.
Yeah.
I mean, part of what we've talked about doing for these podcasts is to invite other people on who went through divorce, you know, either as a parent or as a kid,
mm-hmm.
and to get their, you know, to share what they went through so that they can help people. I mean, the more that we can get this to be a topic of discussion, not a hidden – you know, that's how a lot of problems were back in the day. People just didn't talk about them and things never get resolved. But we need to let people come out here and talk about it, the good and the bad.
Yeah.
So that people will maybe take those stories and maybe that'll change how, if they face divorce or they have a relative who's going through divorce, how they handle their own divorce or advise someone else how they should handle it.
Well, yeah, you brought up the ripple effect before in conversation. And so the more people that can be impacted by these discussions, the better off our communities will be.
Right. As a Wendelberry fan, I'm a huge yeah, local community right. guy. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I mean, communication is usually not something that I think is effective, like, on a big, broad federal scale.
Yeah.
It's something that really takes place in on streets with your neighbors, with
Sean Cleland, man on the street.
Exactly.
Yep.
Right. That's where it's most effective.
That should be a segment.
Face to face. Exactly. So that's what we're trying to do. I mean, I think that if we do this in our local community, you're going to find healthier families, healthier children, less problems, and we'll all benefit from that by having these conversations. So, you know, that's the whole point of this business, really.
Yeah,
is, you know, it's the personal fulfillment of it. Of course, it's great to take some personal strife when you're young and turn it into a positive, but it's knowing you're helping the greater good is a huge pick me up on hard days.
When was the turning point for you when you decided that this is the direction you wanted to go in with your practice?
Yeah, so I mean, I went to law school and I passed the bar in 1996, ancient history. So when I passed the bar, I went right into straight up litigation and nothing to do with family law.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really a purpose. I've always wanted to have a purpose in my life. I mean, I'm Catholic. I went to church a lot as a kid. I don't go as often today as I should, maybe, but I do want to have a purpose in my life. And so I decided maybe I should learn a little bit about family law. You know, I could take this on and take some small cases and learn a little bit about it. But I really came to learn quickly that, I matched up my personal experience with what courts were like today.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that, you know, this doesn't feel right. I know that what people need when they're getting through divorce isn't being solved in the way that courts resolve disputes. And so although I wanted to help, I realized that that was a calling for me at that point, but I didn't have an avenue to do it. I could not possibly try and be a litigator in court and try and be just a nice litigator in the court system. That just seemed to me to be just not going to be effective. I'm not going to be satisfied. I'm going to be frustrated because – as we've talked about, what's frustrating for me, what angers me is when I can't get to the root of the problem.
Yeah.
That's what frustrates me. If I got to argue on the surface, if I got to deal with small issues and not get to the heart of it, that is excruciating for me and I cannot deal with it. So I needed to find an avenue that allowed me to get to the root cause and get to the bottom line of disputes. And that's when, thank God, I found sort of researching, Google.
Yeah.
And so I would look and find things like, mediation training. And I'm like, I thought mediation was just for people who are already in litigation. I found out that there are people who mediate divorces who aren't even attorneys, in fact.
Right.
And they try and resolve it out of court. And I took the training and I was like, wow, this is eye-opening. This is exactly what I wanted to do. Handle it in a way that they could communicate, that I could actually get to the bottom of problems, get them out of that system that kind of forces them to be adversarial and non-communicative. And then I took collaborative practice training, which was another extension of the same principle of just a divorce process that requires you to communicate. So that's really when I learned that's an avenue. And it took me a long time, even though I had the training and I learned all these things, to figure out that I needed to go really hard at this.
Yeah.
I needed to really make this the focus of my practice going forward, not just something I learned and maybe do on the side. That this was my calling, and I need to really try it out. And so it's been kind of an ongoing process, but it's been the thread of my life. It's from when my parents got divorced, you know, from that process, thinking and agonizing over that, to today. I could not set it's a big timeline.
Yeah.
And all things have led to this. It's hard to express that to someone, but that's – my whole life is kind of –
yeah, everything. And we were talking about that before the podcast. I feel the same way. Everything and all of the darkness that I've lived through in my life has brought me exactly to this point where I am working with you and I am working with a recovery group and I have a purpose, and it is – life cannot feel any better to wake up every day and have meaning and to know that what I'm doing is impacting others and what you're doing is impacting others and how we can collectively, you know, find a way to get this messaging out to the people that need to be hearing it.
Right. I mean, there's a it's a new day. It's great to be doing this work because of all the things we've known today.
Yeah.
The other things that we've learned today and, you know, the opportunity to communicate with so many people through things like podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
So this is exciting. I mean,
it does.
I can't imagine wanting to do anything else.
Podcasting?
No. I can't imagine
you
other
like
things.
Podcasting.
I like podcasting. But I mean, helping people go through divorce.
Just, yep.
That's what I was meant to do.
Yep.
You know, I guess in the long run, it sure beat, you know, all my failings in math. I'd rather be good at helping people through divorce and being good at geometry.
I was waiting for the next opportunity to make a math joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you've obviously got
to
hang up on
math. I'm no help to my
math.
Children on math homework at all. I'm really terrible. But if they know someone's going through divorce, I could probably help them out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming. And I really appreciate you sharing your stories. And
anytime.
Maybe we'll encourage some other people to do it with us in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
All right. Thanks.
Take care. To learn more about the mediation and collaborative practice services that we offer, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on the web. Please visit clelandsolutions.com for more information.